Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'll be continuing to talk about your unconscious and how it's protecting you from doing those things you might think you want to do. And I'll be playing the second half of an interview with wonderful pianist Mike Markovarich. So hang on, here comes the show. Welcome to The Lynn Show. Welcome back, if you've been listening. And welcome forward, if this is the first time you've heard this show. I'm incredibly glad to have you here. If you haven't heard the show before, the current format, since I can't quite count on anything, everything staying the same, but the current format, and what has been the format pretty much, I want to say from the beginning, but that's not actually true, but it's been the format for most of the time, is that for the first half of the show, I will talk about concepts in my book. The book is called When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It. It's a book about, well, just that, why people can't always do what they want to do and what to do about it. So I've been working my way through the book, that is, exploring the reasons that we get stuck when we really want to do something and we don't seem to be able to do it or to stop doing something. So I've been working my way through the book. I am currently in the middle of the book talking about our unconscious and how our unconscious stops us from doing things that we think we're ready to do, that we may even think we have to do, but which it, that is our unconscious, knows we are not ready to do. That our unconscious knows that if we do this or stop doing this, the distress that it will cause us will be worse than the distress that we are currently in. Our conscious mind doesn't know this because our conscious mind is just looking at what we want to do, what the world thinks we should do, what other people are doing. But our unconscious knows what is really going on for us. And so it can be seen to be an obstacle to what we want to do. But it's actually a protector. And in the book, I call it our ally. So I talked about Freudian slips as a way of getting information that we may not actually have or even want. I talked about forgetting to remember, so we don't do things we thought we wanted to do, or we can't remember things we think we ought to remember. And today I'm going to talk about the wandering mind. But before I get to that, I want to explain that in the second half of the show, I've been doing a series of interviews called Anatomy of an Artist. That is, I've been interviewing people who make their living or their life with their art, and also those people who support the people who make their living or their life with their art. And in this show, I'm playing the second half of an interview I did with pianist Mike Markovarich, who was blind from birth, and who began at 3 years old trying to pick out the tunes that he heard on the radio on his little toy piano. And in this show, I'm going to play the second half of that interview and also give you an opportunity to hear Mike playing and a piece that he composed. It's so remarkable, and it is such a testament to what the human being can do. And one of the remarkable features of our human psyche is our unconscious and how it leads us, and also how it stops us. So today I'm going to be talking about, as I said, the wandering mind. You see, your conscious mind believes that your safety depends on knowing whatever there is to know. Your conscious mind can be relentless in searching for information. Pressed by their conscious minds, many people feel that they have to stay present, they have to stay vigilant, they have to be attentive and alert, and they're annoyed with themselves, and sometimes even frightened, when they space out, zone out, or lose touch. But one of the most important tools that our unconscious has is its ability to shield information from the prying eyes of our conscious mind. As a therapist, I'm always on the lookout for those moments when somebody shifts his or her attention from listening to me to listening to themselves. I tell everyone who comes to see me to value those moments of inward focus as opportunities to hear from their unconscious, and that the information that they're getting from their unconscious is more valuable to them than any information that I can offer. At these moments, when I notice that somebody has shifted their attention from me to something internal, I often ask, "Where are you? Where have you gone?" And most people initially react like school children being caught not, quote, paying attention to the teacher. They're embarrassed that they've been daydreaming instead of paying attention. And I have to explain to them that this source of information that is coming to them through them is so much more important than anything else I have to say. I have to explain that their daydreams are vital to them. I encourage them to start observing wherever their mind wanders instead of trying to control their mind's movements. And I assure them that when they begin to take their daydreams seriously, they're likely to discover a rich source of information. In fact, I usually stop them and say, "Well, wherever it was you went, whatever that daydream was, do you mind sharing it with me?" And when they do, there's always an important piece of information in it. It's never really random. But even if the information doesn't bear on what we've been talking about, which it almost always does, and I'm going to tell you a story about a client in a second, it's always important to trust the impulse of the unconscious. So, for example, after about a month in therapy, a client named Joel asked me if he could sit in another place in my room. He said he was distracted by this big tree outside of my window. He said, sometimes I just can't help looking at it, and I want to pay attention to what you're saying. And I explained to Joel that his unconscious was carefully monitoring everything I said. It heard everything I said, but it was only letting him hear some things, and it was distracting him from others. And it would distract his attention, for example, when he was overwhelmed or overloaded, or when I was saying something that his conscious mind didn't need to know yet, or just when his unconscious mind decided it wanted his attention. At these times, it would seem to shift his attention suddenly, making him very interested in the tree. But I assured Joel that if I put him in a different seat in my room, nothing would change, because if his unconscious wanted to distract him, it could just as easily cause him to be fascinated by his fingernails. Now, like for Joel, our unconscious may just be distracting us from information that we're not yet ready to process or can't use, or that's too discomforting. But most of the time, especially in therapy sessions, when somebody's mind wanders, when they have a daydream or they are thinking of something that seems unrelated to what we're talking about, there is a definite relationship. And that information can be invaluable. And as I said a minute ago, I'm going to tell you a story about another client of mine. Her name was Marianne. And she was amazed to discover that her unconscious could sneak its message into what seemed to her to be an irrelevant daydream. She came into therapy to deal with an increased sense of anxiety, and she blamed it on stress at work. Her conscious mind clearly thought that it was her work situation that was the source of her anxiety. But as we began to talk, I wondered if it wasn't something else. Marianne was, at 38, engaged for the very first time to be married. And she assured me that her relationship with her fiancé and her upcoming marriage were fine and not the source of her anxiety. So during a session in which I was talking about the way the unconscious can unexpectedly supply us with information, I noticed that Marianne seemed self-absorbed. So when I asked where she was, she blushed and she apologized and she stammered. She was very, very sorry. She said she didn't mean to be rude, but her mind just wandered away. At first, she was really reluctant to say what she'd been thinking about. Then she said it was silly and she couldn't imagine what made her think of it. It was a story that she had heard many, many years before about a young couple who had married and were very happy. However, on their first anniversary, the groom found his bride, dressed in her wedding dress, dead of an overdose of pills. Her suicide note said, "I'm sorry. I don't deserve to be this happy." Marianne had had a painful and cheerless childhood. She, too, was surprised by the joy and pleasure she was finally experiencing with her fiancé. She, too, questioned if she could renounce an unhappy cover that her childhood had forced her to accept as the truth and allow herself to reach for the joyful undercover she'd always hoped for. And here, I think I want to stop and just say, any of you who have not been listening to all the shows, the concept of cover and undercover are, of course, in the book, and I talked about them in earlier shows. So if you're curious about them, you can go up on my website, thelynnshow.com, that's thelynnshow.com, and there are podcasts there, and it'll indicate which ones talk about the cover story, and you can hear about that at length if you want. So Marianne had an unhappy cover story. That was what her childhood taught her to believe about herself. And she wanted the joyful undercover that she had placed there, that is to say, undercover. Always hoped for it, but of course, since her childhood convinced her that life would be miserable, she never really believed in it. So now, when joy seemed to be within her grasp, she was afraid that the curse of her childhood would find a way to spoil everything. Consciously, she discouraged these thoughts. She didn't think about them, and when they popped in, she pushed them out. But her unconscious found a way to get her attention. First, by initiating the anxiety that brought her into therapy, and then, when she was in a safe place, giving her the wandering mind. And of course, in order for her to be happy, she had to expose this concern and deal with it, which is what we did in the following sessions. So, if you have always been vigilant and on guard, if you believe that you must watch out for whatever might go wrong, so a client of mine calls this the Satchel Paige syndrome. If you don't know what that is, ask a baseball fan. If this is true for you, you have almost certainly wasted a lot of your precious time and energy. If you're embarrassed when you do contradictory things or when your mind wanders, then you don't understand that you're a multifaceted human being. You don't understand that the I, what you think of as I, that's your conscious mind, it isn't all there is to you. So for just a moment, try and accept that you have an invisible ally. Believe that you're not alone with your conscious resources. For the present, you may find it a little too frightening or upsetting to accept that you are receiving help from what seems to be an invisible source. Then ask yourself what life might be like if you could accept the fact. And let me assure you, it can be more balanced and more harmonious when you learn to interpret the bulletins coming from your unconscious mind. You get into the habit of trusting your intuitions instead of denying them, feeling embarrassed by them, or being afraid of them. And talking about trusting your intuitions, I'm going to begin the second half of the interview I did with Mike Markovarich with the last thing I played of the first half, in which he tells us so clearly that he hears an instruction to honor his intuition, to follow his love of playing the piano. And trusting that against the largest odds made all the difference. Here I'm thinking of, you know, the road less traveled. Certainly Mike followed the road less traveled, and it made all the difference. So before I play that interview, I'm going to play a cut from the CD he gave me. The CD is called Solid. The particular tune I'm playing is called Where Are You? And features not only Mike on piano, but Tony Martin on drums and Billy Pilateri on bass. And following this gorgeous track, I'm going to play the second half of the interview with Mike Markovarich. Thank you.
My sophomore year, I really prayed hard and thought hard about what it was going to mean to try to embark on a music career. Mm-hmm. And as sure as I'm sitting here, one night I was debating what to do, tossing it and turning it around, you know, in my mind. And as sure as I'm sitting here, I heard this voice. Michael, I know you're way behind the eight ball compared to people who have played piano seriously for 10 or 12 years and had studied a lot of theory and all that, but you have the means to do this, and I will see to it that you are able to do it if you just plunge into it.
Oh, Michael.
So I said, okay, there's my answer. That's all I need to know.
Oh.
I'm going to do it. I'm going to give it the best shot I have, and wherever it leads me, at least I will have been able to say I gave it the best shot I could.
Right.
So I ended up graduating in 1971 from Dartmouth College with distinction in music major. Got a real good music history and music theory background, mostly. But my junior and senior years, I got a chance to study with some jazz musicians who were artists in residence at the time, which was just great. I got a chance to study with Dwight Mitchell, mm-hmm. the pianist. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you know him.
I don't know him.
Wonderful pianist.
Mm-hmm.
And his bassist, Willie Ruff, taught him a jazz history class.
Mm-hmm.
My senior year at Dartmouth, that was. And then in my junior year, I studied with Don Cherry, the cornetist.
Yeah,
the jazz
he is.
What a character. But I learned a lot from him. You know, his approach was more into the free jazz and just somebody start something and the rest of you jump in and put something together from that. You know, it was a lot in that vein.
Mm-hmm.
So I got some exposure to that. And then after Dartmouth, I lived at home with my parents for a while and went back to went to a small college in Nashua called Riviere College, and I studied more classical piano
mm-hmm.
and form and analysis, you know, more music theory.
Wow.
Then I went very briefly to the Berklee College of Music, one day a week for one semester, and I studied jazz, piano, and improv there.
Mm-hmm.
Jazz, piano and jazz theory there. And then my next major move was the University of New Hampshire in 1974.
My goodness, this is years and years and
years. Yeah, yep. And during my studies at UNH, I studied classical piano and played jazz gigs on the side when I could. and I did that as much as I could. And got a chance to study jazz piano with one instructor toward the end. But then in 1978, I graduated with my master's in music, my MA in music mm-hmm. from the University of New Hampshire.
We're looking at 10 years from now, right?
Yep. But, and if you count the time I started playing when I was 3 years old, you figure that in, you're talking almost 30 years.
Yeah, now. Right.
And then in 1978, I moved to Cape Cod, and that's where I spent the first 10 years of my full-time career.
Mm-hmm. What made you go there?
Well, it's an interesting story. I was playing a wedding reception somewhere, and one of the people that was there ran a restaurant in Falmouth, Mass.
Mm-hmm.
Liked my playing and invited me to move down to the Cape once I finished my degree.
Oh.
And play a five-night-a-week position down
there. Well, so graduated right into work.
Pretty much. Mm-hmm. In June of 78, I started my Cape Cod career. Played at Molly's Restaurant in Falmouth, and then the Kuna Messed Inn, and the place is the Bobby Burns Hyannis Pub, and the Asa Bears House in Hyannis, the Paddock Restaurant, Dunphy Hotel.
You must have thought you were going to stay there.
I thought for a while. I thought it was going to be a place for a long time.
Yeah.
Well, 10 years is a fairly long time.
Yeah, it is.
But in about the mid-80s, the economy up there really started taking a hit.
Yes,
and it was hard to even get a gig playing solo piano anywhere, wow. let alone with a combo.
Wow.
That pretty much dried up a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So, and again, another interesting thing happened. Two friends of mine who listened to me a lot on the Cape had a winter place down here in Bradenton. In 1988, they invited me down here to visit. And they, before I came down, did some sleuthing around to see what the music opportunities might be like here. And as it turned out, there was a place on Main Street in Sarasota, which was looking for a pianist to play five nights a week.
What?
Horse Feathers.
Oh,
it's
my God.
No longer here.
I know. It's that other thing on the corner, right?
It was a great place.
Yeah.
And they had, so anyway, so I came down here and visited my friends, the Chandlers, and for about 10 days, and I auditioned at Horse Feathers, and I got the job. So, and within about a month after that, I sort of packed things up, and with the help of my dad, we moved me down here to Sarasota, and I got oriented. He stayed for about a week or a week and a half to help me get situated, learn my way around downtown enough so I could get around on my own, which there's another challenge of being a totally blind person in a sighted world.
Unbelievable.
And by the time he left, I knew where, you know, a few restaurants were in the bank that I was going to go to for do my banking in the post office.
Where
were
you
going to
live?
While I was living, at the time I was living in an apartment on South Osprey Avenue.
So you were close to downtown, so you
Very
could walk?
Very close. I could walk everywhere.
Yeah.
Which was wonderful.
It's wonderful.
Yeah. It really is wonderful. And I got hooked on the weather down here very quickly. I came down here in November of 88, and I said, oh, man, it's in the 70s, it's in the 80s. I can wear shorts like I am right now.
Yeah.
And I said, I like this.
Yeah, just coming from...
from Cape Cod. Yeah. Though New England winters can be pretty hellacious.
Yes.
So I started playing in Horse Feathers, and 2 months later, due to lack of business, it closed.
Yeah.
And here I was. I just moved down here. Oh, man. One gig ended. Well, again, I had sat in a few times at the Gator Club while I was playing in Horse Feathers. Once I got done, I went over to the Gator Club and sat in a few times. And they had a jazz policy there, six nights a week then.
Oh, yeah.
When Jay Foley ran it.
Yeah.
And the bass player that was playing a combo then was Ernie Williford, who I still work with every chance I can.
Mm-hmm.
He's been not only a fun person to play with, but he's been a friend and very helpful to, you know, when that's been needed.
Mm-hmm.
He's a great guy, and he's a lot of fun to work with. And well, he was in this combo at the Gator Club at the time, and the manager at the Gator Club knew what was about to happen at Horse Feathers, because he said to me, well, if something happens at Horse Feathers, and I could it's a small town, you know. A lot of people know what's going on.
Yes, they do.
Especially if they're in the same industry.
Oh, yeah.
They're
all watching.
Sure. And so he said, if something happens at Horse Feathers, you've got a job here, because I've been thinking we've needed to do something with the trio here.
Uh-huh.
So Horse Feathers closed on a Saturday night. I went over to the Gator Club, and the manager was true to his word. He said, I'll tell you what, we have jazz here Monday through Saturday. How about you start Monday night? So I didn't even miss a night's work.
Oh, my God.
So
it does seem like you've been...
Just been in the right place at the right time. And, you know, there's no way of knowing that.
Well, but you trusted that it would be, didn't you?
Well, it was a little scary for a while. I mean, when those things happen, it is a little... So it can be a little unsettling.
No kidding.
But ultimately, usually when one door closes, another one opens sooner or later.
Mm-hmm.
And... Ernie and I and various drummers, mostly Louis Firkovich, played at the Gator Club for 17 months, six nights a week. Then we played over Coasters at Coasters on Siesta Key for 11 months.
Mm-hmm.
And I played at Michael's on East for about 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm at Caragiulo's Thursdays and Fridays and at Euphemia on Sunday nights.
Uh-huh.
So those are my steady jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Now, besides that, I play a lot of assisted living facilities at various times, various days, on a varying schedule.
Yeah.
Depending on what they want, how they want me to fit in, and I'm always looking for concerts and, you know, that kind of work.
And you teach.
And I teach. Mm-hmm. And I've done recording, too.
Yes.
So, it's a busy life. It's a very busy life, but it's been very rewarding. Challenging, yes. Scary at times, yes.
Yes.
But I don't regret deciding to do it at all.
No.
I don't really don't regret it.
And, I want to say again that something that you clearly never lost was this, I don't know, optimism, positiveness.
Well, pessimism gets you nowhere but in worse trouble.
Yeah.
It really does.
No, I agree.
It saps your energy, something wicked.
Mm-hmm.
And the last thing you need if you're going to be doing something creative is to lose your energy.
No, that's
because that's where it comes from is the universal manager. That's where it comes from. You know, whatever you choose to call God,
higher power, the force.
What, or the higher intelligence. Or,
yes, you're right.
What, you know, everybody has different ideas about what they want to call that or whether they believe in that or not. I definitely believe in it.
No, you heard from it, didn't you?
More than once. More than once.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
For sure.
You know, one night you sat in at Baco's.
Yes.
Oh my God. Oh. And you did that thing that I imagine you do a lot, where, you know, one song to another, to another, to another, and culling this and reaching out. What do they call that when you
use throw in quotes from...
Yeah, quoting, right.
Well, quoting is one word for it.
Right.
And the a jazz term that they use for that, at least when I was studying jazz history back in my college years, is interpolation.
Interpolation.
Yes.
Yes.
It means placing... juxtaposing something from another piece of music in the piece you're playing.
Yes,
what it means. And it could be a short quote,
yeah,
a little short excerpt, or it could be more than a short excerpt.
Yeah, and that night, you did a great deal of that.
I do.
Oh, you do, and it was, I mean, you can hear the audience just erupts over, you know, because they recognize it, you know, they know you've gone someplace else.
How do you fit that in?
Yeah, right, and they're so delighted. It's so...
Well, the thought process as nearly as I can figure out how that works for me anyway is that I'm constantly, when I'm playing, I'm listening to the chord changes a lot, you know, and I'm trying to think of something that will fit, even if it fits loosely, even if there's some jagged notes, some off colored notes. If it doesn't fit, I'll bend it.
You will.
Yeah. You know.
So, well, you know what they say about jazz, that if you hit a wrong note...
Keep playing it. It's going to sound right.
That's right.
Yes. There are really no wrong notes.
There
are all kinds of choices,
though.
And that's the beauty of jazz, is that it really is... as many times as I've played a lot of the standards, I've never stopped falling in love with the standards. Mm-hmm. I really think, I'm convinced in my teaching experience also, that one thing that if you're going to try to show somebody jazz piano, you should show them how to play the blues, and you should try to show them how to play standards first before they go any other direction.
Well, I'm delighted to hear it, because, of course, as a singer, the standards are...
They're class. They're timeless.
They're timeless.
Absolutely timeless.
That's right. It's odd. I was having this conversation with Charlie Prodzik.
Uh-huh. You know Charlie? Yeah, I know Charlie.
Yeah,
sure.
I'm sure you did.
I know him, and I think he's a wonderful player.
He's a wonderful player.
Mm-hmm.
He's a wonderful player, and he's a wonderful accompanist.
Yes, he is. Yeah. And I enjoy that, too, when I get the chance to do it.
Yeah. I've never sung with you, so I don't want to speak to that.
No, but we'll have to do that sometime.
I certainly hope so.
I'd like to.
Yes, so would I. And Charlie and I were talking about the standards, and I was saying, so my listeners are going to hear this again twice now, that a lot of pop and rock singers, as soon as they possibly can, they make albums of standards.
Rod Stewart. There's one example.
Oh, yeah.
Linda Ronstadt.
And these are exactly the examples that I gave. Right. And so it's like, you know, these songs, musicians love them.
And there are good reasons for it. I mean, you know, when you think about the repertoire of people like Cole Porter and Gershwin, and Rodgers and Hart and Jerome Kern and Dietz and Schwartz and
Frank Lesser, and, Rodgers and Hart.
Yeah,
did you say that?
Rodgers and Hammerstein. Even the show tunes. A lot of the show tunes are
wonderful
jazz vehicles.
Yeah.
Absolutely, and it's because the melodies make sense.
Yes.
The average listener can grasp what the melody is. Can also grasp what the basic harmony is, as long as it's reasonably played.
Mm-hmm.
And you can go from there.
But it's interesting. The harmonies are interesting.
They are.
They're not complicated. You know, they're not difficult, but they're interesting.
They're interesting enough.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have some jazz techniques under your fingers and some jazz theory, you can plug in some substitute chords, which can make it even more interesting.
I agree. Yeah,
but the stuff is so timeless that... it's as timeless as Bach, or Beethoven, or Chopin, you know, but it's a different idiom, that's all.
Right. Well, and then, of course, the lyrics.
The lyrics, yes.
They are lyrics.
Yeah, they're wonderful lyrics. And you can actually understand what they mean.
Right, exactly. That's exactly right. And they're interesting, you know,
Yes, absolutely.
So, and again, as a singer, you know, the lyrics are so important to me, so.
Yes.
Well,
Well, sure.
Yeah.
They are.
Well, Mike, this is so lovely. This is also incredibly interesting to me. So I always like to, at the, you know, as we're sort of ending, to ask whoever I'm interviewing if there's anything that I forgot to ask or that you would like to talk about or that you have to say about life in music or almost anything that on your mind.
Well, you know, it's just, I guess, I am always, I can honestly say that one of the things that I enjoy most is playing concerts. Either solo or with combos or in any different, any number of configurations.
And why?
Well, lounge work is one thing, and it serves a very valuable purpose, okay? And,
yeah, but people don't really listen.
Well, some do. I mean, you get some. You get some that do and some that don't.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're playing a concert, they are there for one reason. They are there to hear you do what you do.
That's right.
And that is the ultimate satisfaction.
Yes.
For me as a performer, if I can play a concert.
Yeah.
I love playing concerts in churches or concert halls or whatever, wherever I can, you know, that's suitable.
Well, okay. So you're listening and you have a concert venue, Mike is available.
For the right price. You know, assuming that it fits into the calendar and all that stuff.
That's right, right. That's great.
But I do like that, and I enjoy, you know, working with, as I say, other musicians and solo and the whole small combo thing mostly. That's what I've done, is smaller combos.
Mm-hmm.
But it's all fun. It's all fun.
Mm-hmm. And actually, I mean, I think I've said this now a number of different times in different ways. That is the thing that comes across so strongly when you play. It's not only the virtuosity of what you're doing, which is staggering, but it's that it's fun. And it's so it makes it so delightful to listen to.
Well, you know, Oscar Peterson had a lot to do with it. well, in my Cape Cod years, I had the privilege many times of listening to Dave McKenna, who I think is really also one of the top players in that genre of jazz.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got a chance to study with Dr. Billy Taylor for a couple of weeks in 92, and he gave me enough stuff to work on to last me two lifetimes.
I know.
But he's just, you know, he's a wonderful player, too, and a wonderful educator.
He's a wonderful man.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In the late 60s, I was working in the Bronx, and he had this traveling...
Yes, the
Jazzmobile, right?
Jazzmobile, yes.
Right.
Yes.
Well, I was in the Bronx then when he was doing that.
It must have been wonderful.
Oh, it was wonderful.
Oh, what a great player.
And really, I mean, what are we talking about now? That was late 60s.
60s. And
right.
You know. He was, Debbie and I, my wife, Debbie and I went to hear Billy Taylor at Van Wezel a few years back. That night, he played The Man I Love. And we were both sitting there, and Debbie said very quietly to me at the beginning as he was playing, the first time through the song, she said to me very quietly, "He's doing all that with his left hand." Oh my God.
Oh my God.
I mean, he was all over it. He was playing the melody and the chords, all with his left hand and moving around.
Oh my God.
With his left hand alone.
Oh my God.
And my jaw dropped. I couldn't believe it because it sounded so complete.
Yes.
And so rich and full and interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, then after that, he went to playing it the more conventional way.
Right.
But those are things that I like, that I get ideas from when I hear people do things like that.
No kidding.
I like to try to do that once in a while. I don't know whether I'm quite up to his, but he's got a few years experience on me too.
Yeah, and he started.
And he started with jazz very young.
Yes, but it occurs to me that you're still doing what you did with Owen, the organ player. You're listening to stuff and saying, "Yeah, let me see if I can do that."
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah, it's always a work in progress anyway.
Right.
You know, because jazz is pure jazz. Better have some improvisation in it.
Yes.
Otherwise, it ain't
it
jazz.
Ain't jazz.
No,
right?
No, it ain't jazz. It's something else.
Yes.
It's jazzy. It's jazz-like. It sounds like jazz, but it ain't jazz. So, I'm always trying to take some chances, and sometimes the things are going to work exactly as I envisioned them or as I heard them. Sometimes they might not.
Yes.
Quite work exactly as I planned, quote unquote. It's not quite the right word, but exactly as I envisioned it or heard it in my inner ear, you know?
You know, sometimes...
Because you're dealing with fractions of inches here sometimes in making those moves on the piano keyboard or a jump.
Yeah.
You're dealing... If you're a fraction of an inch off...
You're off.
You're off. No, just keep playing that note so it's going to fit.
Sometimes when I'm singing... I'll get this idea of someplace I want to go.
Yeah.
And I'll go there, and then I won't be able to find my way back.
Oh, God. This reminds me of a funny, funny true story that happened a while back. Mm-hmm. I was booked to play a concert at the Sarasota Bay Club with Ernie Williford on bass and Johnny Moore on drums. Mm-hmm. You know the two of them?
Oh, yes.
Wonderful guys. Mm-hmm. Well, here I am. A lot of these people are, you know, 70s and up.
Right.
I started playing There Is No Greater Love, and it was so outside, and I couldn't get back in. The whole concert was like that. The scat singing, everything. Went all the way out there. And I knew I should have been reining it back in, but I couldn't do it, because that thing just got me, and that was it. It was outside, and it stayed outside.
But you know, I mean, you could probably get away with it.
I got away with it, I think. They did hire us back later on, so I guess I didn't really burn any bridges, although Ernie told me a couple of people were giving me a look like, what? Do you know what you're doing?
Playing?
Yeah, what in the world are you playing anyway? Even though I made a point to announce the songs before I played them.
That doesn't mean they knew it.
No.
This is so wonderful for me because I think I'm the only person who does that, you know, that I get this idea
and I get lost.
I get lost too.
I get lost, but sooner or later, you know, something clicks. Mm-hmm. Something clicks, and you get back there eventually. Somehow.
And sometimes for me, it's the piano player. I get, you know, I just listen to what's being played. Oh, yeah. You know, and I go, oh, okay, all right, I'll go there.
when we played at the Gator Club, I can remember I used to, you know, to start doing my quoting. Mm-hmm. You know, and Louie, the drummer, he'd get all in a tizzy because. He'd forget what song we were playing, and Ernie would just say to him, just play time, man. Just keep the time going. Don't listen to him. Don't listen to him.
That is so funny.
Don't listen to him.
Yes, one and two and three.
And just keep the beat going. Don't worry about the rest of it.
Oh, I love that.
So I have my fun. If it ain't fun first, why do it?
Well,
that's you know really why do it?
Yeah, I could not agree more. It's and it seems to me that that's the perfect place to stop this. Mike, this has been so wonderful.
It's been fun for me too.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
So you can hear how much fun we were having, and I hope that it was fun for you too. I hope that some of the pleasure that we're experiencing is coming through the airwaves and lightening your day. And not only is it lightening the moment that you're listening, but I hope that these interviews are communicating the capacity to trust your instincts, to listen to your intuitions, to know that your unconscious is telling you who you are and what's possible for you. At least to consider the possibility of listening to those little voices, those little impulses, which you may have, you know, heard and discounted or maybe even figured out not to hear anymore, since we live in such a loud world. Anyway, I'm hoping that these interviews trigger a little bit, a lot, a huge amount of your capacity to surface those parts of yourself which you may have been in denial for. And now I'm going to play a piece called Blues for Joe Green, which was composed by Mike Markovarich, and he told me that it's based on a piece by Giuseppe Verdi, alias Joe Green, another example of Mike's sense of humor. And Mike sent me the piece by Giuseppe Verdi, but I can't get it into the software that allows me to get it into this show. So when my IT guy, Josh Hackney, who I talk about in every show, comes, I'm going to ask him to put it in this software, and then in a later show, I'll play a piece from Giuseppe Verdi's piece and probably play Blues for Joe Green again, but I didn't want to leave it out of this show. So, as I am often doing, I'm running out of time, and before I run out of time, I'm going to play Blues for Joe Green by Mike Markovarich. Isn't that wonderful? And I want to say again that the bass player on that cut is Billy Pillicherry, and the drummer is Tony Martin. And the CD is called Solid, and it is by Mike Markovarich. And you can reach Mike by calling him at 941-951-1487, or you can get in touch with him through me. And you can get in touch with me at my website, which is thelynnshow.com, thelynnshow. On my website, you can also get the book from which all the information at the beginning of the show is coming, and my own CD, the songs from which the first song in the show and the last song in the show come from my own CD called I Won't Go With a Whimper. And there are other things you can get from my website. I want to thank Mike for two really wonderful shows, and I want to remind you that this month is all about piano players. Next week, I'm going to be playing a young piano player named Elliot Roth, and in the last week, I'm going to play an amazing person, Lillette Jenkins-Wisner. So if you are interested in piano, interested in music, interested in jazz, interested in interesting people, please tune in again next week. I want to say yet again a huge thank you to Josh for making everything that I do here possible, and to tell you that not only can you get information about Mike and anybody else that you hear on my show by going up on my own website, thelinshow.com, but you can get in touch with Josh, and if you have any needs, electronic, computer, recording, phone, whatever it is, Josh Hackney is the guy. And again, you can get in touch with him by going up on my website. And I want to remind you that you're receiving a steady stream of information from your unconscious. And I want to encourage you to allow it to help you by using slips of your tongue and causing you to forget to remember and encouraging your mind to wander in many, many other ways, making you act like somebody you may not recognize. Your unconscious is teaching you about yourself. It's constantly telling you who you are, as well as stopping you from doing things that you're not yet ready to do. Let yourself listen and learn, because the most important lessons you'll ever learn are those about yourself. I hope, as always, that you got something from this show that you can use, or something that entertained you, or something that engaged you. In any case, something that made you want to come back and listen again. And I will be here next week, same time, same station, and I sure hope that you will be too.
I'm getting older, my hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring, I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. Singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. See that I have had my shot. My time is come. Get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have got